Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Norton Mazvinsky, historian and activist, is currently writing a book titled, Is a Jewish State a Good Idea? Is it a good idea in the Middle East? This book culminates Professor Mazvinsky's close to seven decades of thinking about the State of Israel and about the Palestinian community. His thinking about the role of Jewish fundamentalism and Christian Zionism and the relationship of Israel to the United States of America. Some years ago, I had the pleasure of hosting Norton in Edmonton for several lectures on the demanding geopolitical issues that so often frame our understanding of Israel-Palestine. We also traveled and lectured in Syria and Turkey and engaged colleagues in the Muslim community. Norton is a considerable critic of Israeli political policy towards the Palestinians. This has often garnered the ire of supporters of the government of Israel and the favor of supporters of Palestinians. I have also watched as he carefully and forcefully responded to his audiences and taught them to distinguish between political criticism of the State of Israel and the kind of anti-Semitism such critique can mask. In our conversation, we explore his childhood formation in a loving Orthodox Jewish family in Ames, Iowa, his study with a teacher of Hebrew and Bible several days a week in Des Moines, beginning when he was five and continuing through his 18th birthday, his reading of Mordecai Kaplan, the founder of the Reconstructionist movement and author of the seminal book Jewish Civilization, was the beginning for his thinking about the implications of Zionism, and his thinking developed through his friendship and work with Rabbi Elmer Berger of the American Council for Judaism. Norton's father came to Ames, Iowa from Ukraine in 1912, aspiring to live as an Orthodox Jew among non-Jews, something he couldn't do in his homeland. As Norton took me back through his life to his childhood, it was his father's vision that I began to see as the effective kernel unfolding through Professor Mazvinsky's life and work. I welcome you to our conversation.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
So what have you been, working on and thinking about lately, Norton?
First, let me talk about what I'm thinking about, what I'm into writing now. Now I'm into writing something that is really something where I draw upon what I've done, what I've thought about, what I've written about in parts, what I've spoken about for a long time. A long time? What's a long time? Oh, since I was in my early to mid-20s, so that means 6 to 7 decades. I'm going to write a book that I've decided to title, Is a Jewish State a Good Idea? I think that in the title what I'm going to do is, I'm going to make it into a, and I did this in a talk and it went over very well. The title's going to be, Is a Jewish State, parentheses, in the Middle East, parentheses, a good idea? Then I'm going to explain at the beginning that I'm really writing a book about this topic generally. Is a Jewish state a good idea, period? But for two reasons, I want to also say something about why that is there in the Middle East, for two reasons. One, because that will expand the interest of the book. I mean, certainly, if I ask that question of is a Jewish state a good idea to Palestinians, most of them are going to be concerned with whether that's a good idea or not in the Middle East, or right where they've had their problem or problems. Okay, that's one of the reasons. The other reason is, I'll say, that there is, that I also have, I don't know whether I'm going to, what adjective I'll use yet, ethical or moral, or probably not that. But, you know, there is a question about, well, even if I think that ethically, morally, however you want to put it, a Jewish state is not a good idea, well, isn't there something to be said in answer to that? Okay, you don't think it's a good idea, but shouldn't there be self-determination in this sense? If Jews want to do it, some Jews, and they want to do it in a place where they're not going to hurt anybody else, and they just go do it, Norton Mezvinsky may not like it, other people may not like it, they don't have to go there, but there is also that question. So I'm just telling you what the thought context for the book is.
Mm-hmm. Where does this, I mean, you said you've been thinking about this since your early 20s, six, 7 decades ago, and you have done so much in this area, and you've done it in many places around the world, and we've done a few things jointly in parts of the Muslim world. Where does this come from for you?
I'll tell you.
How did this preoccupation come from?
Well, I'll tell you where it comes from. I mentioned this not quite in this context, but very briefly when I started my talk yesterday that you unfortunately couldn't hear. I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. Okay. But I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in Ames, Iowa. Now, Ames, Iowa is 27 miles from the large city in the capital, Des Moines, where there's a Jewish community, the largest Jewish community in Iowa. Now there's three synagogues and so on. All right. Now, when I grew up in Ames, Iowa, all of this is key to answering your question. When I went through school until I got into high school, I was the only Jew. So all my friends were not Jewish. And those were my very best friends. And I grew up in that kind of a society. And I knew when I was young how valuable that kind of society was. Mm-hmm. It also fitted in a sense, to my father's approach before I was born about why he came to Iowa. It's not fully the same reason, but when he came from Kiev as a young man, 11, 12 years, 13 years old.
About what year?
1912. When he came, he decided that what he wanted to do, he was coming to the new world, he was going to, in his mind, he was going to throw the old world into the ocean. He never wanted to go back. And he said he wanted to be able to do a couple things that he could never do in his old world and other Jews couldn't do. He wanted to be able to live as a religious Jew among non-Jews and to have the equal rights that they have in that community. And that's what he did in Ames, Iowa. He became a patron saint of the town in lots of ways. So I grew up in that environment. And I grew up in an environment, for example, and don't forget, this was, after all, I graduated high school in 1950. That was when the McCarthy years started. Okay. But so I was in high school and in primary school, the 40s, when I was in third grade, at Christmas time in those days, they always sang Christmas carols and all of that. The teacher came to me, I'm the only Jew. She came to me in class and she said, if you want to be excused when we sing Christmas carols, you can be. I said, let me talk to my parents. I was in third grade. I talked to my parents. My mother, of course, wouldn't hear. My father said to me, listen, you stay in school. You don't have to sing the carols, but you don't come home, but you stay there with all your friends, and that's the way we are here. Now, two or three times a week, my father would have one of his people take me from age 5, and I studied to age 18, to Des Moines, so I could study with an Orthodox Jewish teacher. My father first looked to see if there was an after-school school, and there was. All the synagogues got together, and he went and he looked at that school, and he decided they don't learn anything there that he thought was worthwhile. Then they told him about this one man who was, we call the Jack, I'm sorry to be long, but the story holds. This man was what we call, to use a colloquial phrase, a jack of all trades. In Des Moines, he was a teacher. He was the shochet who killed the animals for the two kosher meat shops, and he was the moil who did the circumcisions. Mm-hmm. But they threw him out of the school. Why? Because if someone came to class. I don't know if it was true with they didn't have the boys would come to class and hadn't done the lesson. He wasn't opposed to giving him a little slap. So they said, we fired him because of that. When my father heard that, my father said, that's the teacher I want to get.
That's right.
Okay.
That's who Norton needs.
Okay. Now, so I studied with him. And my father told me this. My father said, you're obligated to study with him until you're bar mitzvah, 13. Then it's up to you. He told my brother the same thing. My brother decided to quit at the bar mitzvah. I studied with him all the way through high school, and he taught me everything he knew. Now, his knowledge was by definition limited, but listen, we studied Bible pretty well. We translated from Hebrew into Yiddish, and then we conversed in Yiddish. So I really learned Yiddish, but I also learned Bible. Maybe he was limited in how much Talmudic stuff he really knew, but he taught me everything he knew. So when I went to the University of Iowa, and all of this is pertinent, Iowa then was one of the very few universities in the country and the only state university that had a Department of Religion. Because in those days, this division of church and state, was, as you probably know, was, you know, Stanford had, but Stanford was not a state school. So they had a department. It was interesting. They had in that department, they had two Protestant scholars, one Roman Catholic scholar, and one Jewish scholar. Okay. So when I came, there were a few students who had come from Chicago, New York, and so they went into that department too. I knew more than all of them because I had a good private teacher.
You had a teacher, okay. Yeah.
All right. Now, I could go on and on about that, but you get the, and then that inspired me to do more. And I had really great teachers. The first one was someone who went on to the Jewish Theological Seminary, then went to Yale and was a professor of the top Jewish professor of Judaic studies at Yale for 20 years, and he's a great authority on what we call Pirkei Avot. You know what Pirkei Avot is. Okay, all right. And the second one was Frederick P. Bargerbohr, a German Jew, thick German accent, whose real field was Arabic love poetry.
Oh, wow.
And he would come to class juggling 8 or 10 books that he would sometimes drop. He would oftentimes say, I forgot to look at my mail. We could never follow him. You couldn't take notes. He would say, I forgot my mail. And he'd go out and forget to come back. Now, when students graded teachers, they always graded him down low. Okay. Now, I didn't grade him down low. But I'll tell you this, and this is not only true of me, it's true of a few others that I've kept up with. After I got to graduate school and after graduate school, and now I would say he's one of the best teachers I've ever had. Why? Because I remember things that he taught me. Well, okay. So I'm saying here I had, now this provides a contextual framework. Here I'm in Ames, Iowa, and here I have this Orthodox Jewish thing. And by the way, I was really Orthodox, and my good friends knew it. And it didn't matter. I kept kosher. Well, I mean, I didn't eat any meat out. I mean, I didn't keep strictly kosher like Yaakov Shapiro. But it meant when I traveled with the football team or I wrestled in high school, they all knew that Norton is going to not eat this and so on. And okay, fine. So that's how I grew up. And that's why the one thing that always, when I was Orthodox, I was religious, but the one thing that always bothered me from as long as I can remember was the emphasis in some of those prayers on chosenness. Mm-hmm. Thank you, God, for choosing us from the other people. And so those prayers bothered me when I was 10 years old.
Why did they bother you?
They bothered me because I had this religion, but I didn't think for a moment that Jews were better, were superior, or were closer to God than any other people. I was convinced I knew better. And I knew better not only because of, not because of thinking, I knew better because I experienced that. I mean, when I got to high school, junior and senior year, my father didn't have to have someone from the store drive me in. My best friend named Dewey Fitch, who was a Methodist, he would drive me the 27 miles. He would wait for me. He would drive me back. And my mother would give us both egg sandwiches because that's what he liked. Now, am I going to think that there are Jews around, especially Jews I don't even know in other parts of the world, who have a soul that is different and superior from the soul of Dewey Fitch? Mm-hmm. No way. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so that is what you might call, you call it sociological, you've got whatever you want to call it, that's the contextual framework.
It's deeply human.
Yeah.
It's okay. Deeply human.
All right. All right. So, but there's one other big element. This was a family where Zionism was important. It wasn't emphasized, but we had relatives in Israel. One of our relatives was Menachem Perush on my mother's side, who I may have told you once, was not only a leading Orthodox rabbi, he was for 27 years, he was the top spokesman for all the religious parties in the Knesset.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so when I started college at the University of Iowa,
That would have been what year?
That was 1950, in the fall of 1950. I had in my head, I hadn't decided I'd do it, but I had in my head that I might finish my 4 years and I might do my aliyah and go to Israel to live. But as I said yesterday in my lecture, because I talked about Mordecai Kaplan and Reconstructionism, I said that was also the year that I was questioning my faith. I started to question things. I was still keeping kosher. My father was shipping me kosher rib steaks in dry ice to Iowa City, to where I lived in the fraternity house. But I also, that's the year that I found Judaism as a Civilization, Mordecai Kaplan's first book and his magnum opus, published in 1935, and I read it, and it's been almost 70 years. I've read everything he wrote, and I went to see Mordecai Kaplan at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and so he inspired me too. All right. And this chosenness business is really what hit me, because he excised all of that out of the prayer books that he used in the Reconstructionist movement. Okay, among other things. So then I was questioning, I remember the first thing that I really questioned that seemed to me to be absolutely, at the time it seemed, I thought to myself, not only how could this be, but it had to be ridiculous. That was 1950. In 1950, the Orthodox Jews, Orthodoxy said, the world was 5,709 years old. Today, it's 5,700, either 9 or 10. Today, it's going to be 70, starting the end of September. 5,000, okay. Now, then I go to, I don't know, did I ever tell this story about what happened when I, with Elmer Berger?
I don't recall.
All right. So I go to Iowa City, and I'm in college, and I'm in the Department of, I'm really majoring in history, but I studied in the Department of Jewish Studies. And they started, when I was there, actually they started my junior year. In the history department, they started an honors program. Well, if you just start a program, you don't get many people. So there were only two people in it, a young woman, and myself. The young woman decided that she'd do it in Russian history. And she did with Rizanovsky, who was really a great Russian historian, who then went to Berkeley and made his big name at Berkeley. I did it. I wanted to work on immigration and Jewish immigration. I was interested in that. That let me combine my interests in the United States, American history, Jews, that stuff. So I was there. That's what I did. And I decided to do an undergrad. You had to write a thesis, an undergraduate honors thesis. So I decided to write it on, I picked my topic, and the topic, of course, was an assumption made before you do, that you shouldn't make before you do your study. I decided I'm going to write a thesis on anti-Zionist propaganda in the United States.
Mm, wow.
Okay. And then I found, to my surprise, because I didn't know this existed, the University of Iowa Library then had really one of the better collections on what was called, I don't know what they didn't use the word extremist, but that kind of stuff. And so I found that there was something that I never expected to see, that out of 26 or 27 American Jewish organizations, There was one national organization that was anti-Zionist. It was called the American Council for Judaism. So I got some of their stuff. And I saw that he was then the executive director. He was the ideologue. He was the intellectual center of this. But I just saw his name. It was Rabbi Elmer Berger. Hmm. So I wrote a letter to Rabbi Elmer Berger. I decided I was smart enough at the time to know I'm not going to put in the title of my thesis. I'm just going to say I'm writing a thesis on that would deal with Zionism and Israel and views in the United States. And, you know, okay. I was fair enough, but I didn't have to know. Okay. So I write him, and lo and behold, what? He writes back a nice letter. He sends me a lot of material. I go through all the material. In my undergraduate thesis, I have one chapter that I devoted to the American Council for Judaism. Mm. And I tried my best to put down what they said. And then I offered my refutation. And then I thought to myself, since Rabbi Elmer Berger, was so good and kind and nice to send me material, even though he's not going to like what I wrote, I'm going to send him the whole thesis.
So tell me first, what was your refutation?
My refutation was that, I had a few. My refutation was, first of all, that I was sold on the idea that this was right after the Holocaust, that Jews needed a state, mm-hmm. that you shouldn't really oppose that, that you had to be open and concerned for that. It's before I'd done a lot of work on this, obviously. And also, I thought that, well, this was an organization made up of Reform Jews. Mm. And that's Reform theology. And not only Reform theology, but I learned a little bit because I did some work outside of what, or in addition to what Elmer Berger sent me. And I found out that the others were, many of the others, not all, I couldn't tell them any, because they had some thousands of members. But they were very wealthy people. And I didn't think they knew much about Judaism and so on. So it was that kind of. So I wrote it. I sent it to Elmer Berger, to my surprise. This is before computers. I get back a 3-page, single-space type letter from Elmer Berger that I understood at the time that he went through every one of my arguments, tore me apart, but did it with kid gloves on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I knew that's how, you know, I was impressed. First of all, I was impressed by the substance. But then I was really impressed by how he did it, because he understood.
And his spirit.
He understood who he was dealing with.
Right, yeah.
You see, I mean, you know, so, and he also said at the end, whenever you have a chance to come to New York, mm-hmm. let me know. And if you'd like, he said, I'd like to talk with you. I'll take you to lunch and we'll have a talk. Well, we often, not often, but we went to a couple times a year because my mother's sister lived in Englewood, right across the George Washington Bridge. So we went to New York, so I wrote him. And I remember, boy, where he took me, the American Council for Judaism. They were right on 57th and Lex on the second floor. And there was a restaurant just about a block and a half away. And we went there, and we talked for 3 hours. I noticed he had 3 martinis during the 3 hours.
That's wonderful. You know,
but he really impressed me. Well, let me cut this short. Elmer Berger was the first person who really started to influence me. Then I started to study myself. And by then, I was in graduate school. Then I went to grad school at University of Wisconsin. I was lucky there, too, because they just started the Department of Hebrew Studies. And they brought 2 fabulous scholars. One, Menachem Mansour from the Hebrew University, an Egyptian Jew, who had this wonderful thing about from what he had done during World War II, but he was a great scholar, and he was working on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he was one of the scholars who put together the scroll of the Hodayot, the scroll of Thanksgiving hymns. He did it. Mm-hmm. So they brought him to head the department. And the other one was a young guy who went from Iowa to Chicago, University of Chicago, and then he became the head for many years of the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. So, you know, these were people of... Okay. Now, they were not really Zionists or anti-Zionists, but I learned a lot from them. So, but I then changed, and after I came out of graduate school, got my first job in New York. Well, that's after, no, my first job was 3 years. I went to Harvard. I mean, I was a research fellow at Harvard. I won a scholarship, and I did that. And then I went to City College. And while I was at City College, in 1967, I became, Elmer Berger was the American Council for Judaism still. And now he called himself the executive vice president. Well, the president was just a rich guy who lived in Chicago. So I became the executive director of the American Council for Judaism, and I became the closest friend to Elmer Berger.
So this shift, Norton, of growing up with a pretty standard Zionist perspective, yeah. Because after all, in the late 40s and 50s, what had happened in the Holocaust becomes vivid, and the whole issue of the unfolding of Israel as a state becomes an extraordinary chapter in the history of the 20th century. This shift, it begins, does it take place sort of slowly because of these people that you met and were talking to? Or is there a moment where you actually kind of made a decision?
It took a while, but it didn't take very long. And also, now I don't know whether there is a link or a connection between two things I'm going to say that I've already said, but I'll put them together. I don't know whether there's a, but it, there could be. This came at the same time that I really moved away from the essence of Orthodox Jewish theology. I didn't move away from Orthodoxy because that's what I was brought up as. That's what I feel, you know, the only synagogue I really feel at home in is an Orthodox synagogue. Mm-hmm. Even though I've told myself a long time ago that it's best if I try not to even read again a lot of those prayers, and because it's just really for the atmosphere. The one who sums up this kind of thing the best in two words is Don Wallace, whom you've met. He says Norton is an unorthodox Orthodox Jew. So you see, that's why I'm drawn to Yaakov Shapiro. We become extremely good friends, but that's why we have, when we meet once every 7 to 10 days and we talk theology, that's why when we raise our voices at one another. But I'm saying that this occurs. So they're, in a sense, two different things, but not fully and totally. But there is one way that it is connected. What I did, because then I did a lot of, I tried to do as much reading and research as I could with my time in all of this. And I, of course, then found the traditional, historic, Orthodox antagonism to Zionism. That affected me too. Not because I thought that, well, it's going to be a sin if you try to have a state before the Messiah comes. Because I already was doubting what Messiah,
what
Messiah meant, yeah. But in a lot of other things, and then so, but there they are, and I then looked at Israel all the more, and that's also, you see, I came to this. Yes, the religious part of it was important, but actually, I built more in more recent years on the religious part of it because Elmer Berger was into this, so then I got into it, into the Palestinian problem. And as soon as I got into that, and as soon as I saw the suppression, then Zionism, if it hadn't been all over for me before, I threw it out about as fast as I could, especially when so I really moved in that direction, and I became even... Elmer Berger, who was an intellectual giant for me in this sense, and he was also an activist, but I mean, I became rather quickly far more of an activist.
So when you saw what was being done Palestinian people...
When I saw what was being done, when I then did the reading, when I then... it was not terribly long. Well, it was after I turned. But when I saw some of the scholarship... First, I saw scholarship by Arab-Palestinian scholars. But then I saw the scholarship also of the Israeli-Jewish scholars about what happened, we'll say, in 48, let alone what's happened since. And I was really impressed with the Israeli Jewish scholars, not because I wasn't more impressed that they were Israeli Jews rather than Palestinians, but I was impressed that they did their work in the Israeli state archives. So here we have the Israeli evidence. Now, it's not that I doubted the Palestinian evidence, but now this is even more primary.
Yeah.
Okay. So then that developed. And by the time I was teaching in Connecticut, after all, in the early 1970s, I'm the one who really went to an organization in New York, and I got the $1,500 to do it. We brought over Fawzi El-Asmar, who was already a poet. He'd never been able to go to a university. He was house detained. And the only way he could get out of house detention was to come to the States. And I arranged, it was easier then. We couldn't do it these days, not just for Palestinians, but for anybody. I got him admitted to the university, to my university, even when he didn't have a very good, he didn't have a command of English. I got the best person in the English department who happened to teach English as a second language. And so Fawzi really studied with him, and Fawzi ended in 3 years with high marks. But I brought him, he had nothing. He was very proud. I couldn't tell him, I'm going to give you the money you need or the, you know, but I said, listen, I need a place now in Connecticut too. But I didn't. So I got the apartment that was big enough for two of us and so on. And he didn't lie. I said, I'll mark down everything I spend for you. So I did. I marked it all down. He saw that I marked it down. When he graduated the University of Iowa, I said, here's my present. I gave him the book. So, all right, but
he's an eminent Palestinian. He's an eminent poet.
Yeah. He unfortunately died prematurely, but he became very eminent. But Fawzi became,
and he's Muslim.
No, he's Christian.
He's Christian.
He's a Christian. But anyway, but Fawzi became, and we were like brothers. We lived together for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. How was the response of your family to your shift?
I'll tell you. First, let me start early. 1967, when after the 67 war, I published for the first time, and I criticized Israel. One of the times that I came back home to Ames, Iowa, no, not before I came back. Every Sunday, I would call my parents. One Sunday, I called my father. I could tell he had tears in his eyes. He said to me, I'll tell you what I was living on. I had just gotten a job as an instructor at City College. And I wasn't living very high, but to live as I was living, I needed a little more. So my father sent me sort of a monthly stipend from the business in Ames, Iowa. My father said to me, listen, I've had rabbis call me from the United States and from Israel and other people, and they tell me, my son, by what he's writing and speaking, is helping the Arabs kill the Jews. That's the way he put it. He said, you're of age, you make your own decisions, but he said, I simply can't support this. I understood him, but of course, it brought tears to my eyes. Let me just say here, though, that it didn't take long. A few months later, when I talked to them, he said, you know, he said, I'm still having people call me. But he said, now I tell them, Norton is over 21, and he's got his own telephone, and he's got his own address. And if you want to say things that you don't like about what he says or does, call him. Then a few months later, he told me that he's even stronger with those people. So he pretty much give it. That's that. Now, in the family, I remember one spring, I forget now the exact year, but it had to be in the early 70s. That's after I brought Fawzi over. I'll tell you a great story about Fawzi and my father, too. I brought Fawzi over. I went home for Pesach, for Passover, and my mother would always make, we'd have relatives come in. I mean, we had 14 or 15 people for dinner. We're sitting around the table. Both my sisters have passed away. My sister Minna's husband was named Saul, and he was a big Zionist. and we were around the table, and I knew that. So, I mean, when I would go for the family thing, I didn't want to get into this kind of, why should I do that for the family? How is it for the family? But it came up at the table, and he asked me a question or two, and I answered it. And he said, "You belong in jail." That was my brother-in-law's view. Okay? So, I mean, yeah. Now, my sister apologized to me, but otherwise, no. But my father, I was going to tell you, after he had said Norton's his own man and so on, call him. Then my father told me a few months later, he said, now, I still get calls when they call me. He said, listen, he said, I don't understand exactly everything Norton is writing and saying, but I know this. He's for peace. And if he's for peace, he can't be all wrong. So I figured, boy, it can't get any better than that.
Mm-hmm.
See? Wow. So that's my answer to your question about the family.
Mm-hmm. So you, in your family, you also have relatives, you mentioned them earlier on your mother's side, who have been in the leadership of religious Jews in Israel, and you know them, and when you go to Israel, you've also spent time with them. Do they fall on both sides of this equation about whether to affirm Israel as a state, as certain Zionists do, or to be critics of Israel as a state, as
of my relatives, except one, are firm Zionists. They're firm Zionists on different levels and different degrees. But let me give you the top degree. Because I would go, this happened, when I went all during the 70s into the 80s, usually when I went to Israel, the first people I stayed with, there were a few exceptions, but the first people I stayed with were an aunt and uncle of mine, and I stayed with he wasn't really quite my uncle, but we called him my uncle. Menachem Perush in Meisharim, the Orthodox section of Jerusalem. And he would always have me there. And he was really something. When he spoke to me in English, and he spoke, he had this clipped Oxford accent. And he was a very tall man, and boy, I mean, he was a orator. So we would sit and talk, and I'll tell you, this happened in the 1980s. And this happened in the year, maybe, I don't know whether it was 83 or 85, I forget now, I've got it in my notes. This is when the United States had developed the newest fighter bomber jet that they had, was the F-15. And the news had come out before I went to Israel that the U.S. government gave those planes for use to the Israelis before the U.S. military used those planes. So I go to Israel, and Menachem Perush picks me up at the airport, takes me, and it was Friday. I got there Friday in the early afternoon. So that meant we have Friday dinner, and so we go to his apartment. So we're having a discussion before dinner, and we get into the business. We always get into discussion of the conflict. So we would have a little argument. He was always terrific. So in the middle of the conversation, he said to me, because what he would say to other people too, and he always told me, he said this, he would always say, Norton is a good Jewish boy from a good Jewish family with a good Jewish heart. He just has wrong ideas. Okay. That's how he would describe it. Okay. Now, okay. So he said to me in the middle of the conversation, he pointed his finger at in my face, and he said, you should understand that God is on our side. So I said to him, listen, if God is on your side, what do you need to have F-15 firebombers from the United States for? Then my aunt came in and said, it's dinner time. So that explains it to you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time I went and he picked me up. And of course, he was Menachem Perush. He would come right out to the plane. So he comes out to the plane, pick me up. We go and I have to get my bags. So I'm going through, and so here I felt bad for this little clerk. You know, it's a clerk, you know, and what they do is, what bags do they inspect? They just, it's by random, and they, you know. So I'm coming through, and the guy says, I'm going to open, we'll have to open your bag. Menachem Perush looked at him and swore at him in Hebrew and said, you touch that bag, you lose your job. So that explains it.
So have you begun on the book?
Yeah, I'm into the book, and I'll tell you the way I'm going to write this book. The first part of the book is going to be as it should be when historians write some things. It's going to be the definition part. And I'm going to spend time talking about the different definitions of Jewish state. I mean, obviously, I can't talk about all of them. I can't talk about what I talk about in full depth, but I have to get across the idea there are different definitions, and mm-hmm. I have to deal in that section as objectively as I can with major definitions which vary tremendously. Jewish and non-Jewish, mm-hmm. because after all, we said the evangelicals, they mm-hmm. had this Jewish concept. Yaakov Shapiro says very well in his big magnum opus, it goes back to the 15th century. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, that's what I'm going to do in the first part. Then, I'm going to explain the division into three parts in the beginning. Then I'm going to talk about a Jewish state, namely the state of Israel. That's a Jewish state in the Middle East. I'm going to deal with that, and that's where I'm going to deal with the Palestinian problem, plus, of course, these other problems about state of the Jews and how anti-democratic it is for Jews and all of that. Okay. But that I'm going to deal with that. Then in the last part, I'm going to talk about why, given that there is an argument for self-determination as long as you don't oppress other people, and I'm going to say that, and I'm going to say, I understand that, and so on. So I'm going to say, this is not a matter of what I think is right or what I think is wrong. This is a matter of my own judgment, as I'm going to put it here. And so I'm then going to argue against a concept of a Jewish state anywhere. And I'll make some comparisons to Christian states, Islamic states, and so on.
Will that argument also have a theological dimension? Would you make the argument that Yaakov Shapiro makes? About this?
About what? Well, I don't know which.
About the fact that a Jewish state, it isn't, it's a non sequitur because devout Jews.
They don't believe, that's right. Yes, of course. I'll have to deal with the, you know, and then for the argument about, well, what about, because there are the three oaths, as you know, in the Talmud, what about if and when? Mm-hmm. The Messiah comes. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the answer to that is when the Messiah comes, the world is not the same and it's totally different anyway. And so a nation state may be a topic of old history.
Right. Nation state won't mean the same thing.
No, that's right.
Certainly to the Jewish imagination
around
the Messiah. And
it will still be, and whether or not, and you know, and Yaakov Shapiro is very, very good at this argument when he says that the promise of land was not a problem of a state. It was a problem. It's the Holy Land. And it doesn't say that only Jews can live in the Holy Land.
Yes, and it's also interesting to me, all of the arguments that have been made about the very name Israel. And, you know, the giving of that name,
right.
The changing of the name of the patriarch to that, and then how it's used in the Hebrew scriptures. And, of course, most often it's used as a designation of faithfulness.
That's right.
Faithfulness about being in communion
That's
with
right.
God.
That's right.
It's not used about Eretz Israel. It's not used about land.
That's right.
Yeah, it's good. It's lovely to see you. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you for joining us. Norton is a distinguished university professor emeritus at Central Connecticut State University, and is president of the International Council for Middle East Studies, an academic think tank in Washington, D.C. Both as a historian and activist, he has written and lectured widely. Let me draw your attention to his book, Jewish Fundamentalism in Israel, published with Israel Shahak in 2004, and his essay, the Christian Zionist vision of Islam in the book Islam in the Eyes of the West, published in 2010. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.